Thank you, Mark, very much indeed. And may I wish you a very happy and fruitful new year. It's very good to see you, especially if you're here for the very first time. A warm welcome to you. So glad you've been able to come and join us this lunchtime. Now, as Mark says, our aim over the next 5 weeks is to do exactly what our series says on the tin. The title is Christianity Explored. And I want us to explore the claims of Jesus Christ as if we're looking at the Christian faith for the very first time. What is it that Christians believe? Is it true? Does it stand up to scrutiny? And what would it look like if I were to decide to follow Jesus? As Mark said, we're following in this 5-week series the content of the course that we run here called Christianity Explored. We've slightly compacted it and squeezed it into this brief 40-minute period. And I want to say up front that our aim is not to brainwash anybody, never is here. Our aim is not to enter into any form of emotional blackmail. We wouldn't want to embarrass anybody in any way. We simply want to go to the source documents, the eyewitness accounts of Jesus' life, to look at what the eyewitnesses have to say of him, and then to come to our own conclusions. Now, our source, then, is Mark. And Mark's account, we were given a copy of it as you came in through the door, I hope. Mark's account of the meaning of Jesus' life comes from a man called Peter. And Peter dictated it to Mark in Rome, sometime between 60 and 70 AD. Peter was one of Jesus' closest followers, and he was specifically commissioned by Jesus to give an account of the meaning of the life of Jesus. Therefore, we have in our hands eyewitness material from Peter, as he was known, an apostle, an eyewitness with authority. I think it's worth saying, some people fuss that it was 60 AD before anybody wrote down, 60 to 70 AD before anybody wrote it down. The reason they took so long to write it down wasn't because, as some would suggest, the apostle Paul was actually putting his gloss onto the Christian faith. You may hear that on the telly sometimes in the Da Vinci Code and that sort of thing. No, the reason they took so long to write it down was that they were still alive to tell the story. So for the first 20, 30 years, these eyewitnesses were everywhere preaching and speaking and convincing people of the truth of their eyewitness testimony. As they got to begin to see that they were about to die, as one does, they decided it was time to write it down. And so between 60 and 80, 90 AD, we get the eyewitness records of the life of Jesus written down. Written, incidentally, in as far apart as Turkey, Italy, and Israel, all places no doubt we've been on our holidays, but a long way apart. So no great collusion or anything like that between them all. So there we are for the next 5 weeks. It is a course. I would encourage you to try and block out the next 5 Thursday lunchtimes to be with us week on week. It is for anybody, and please do invite anybody. As I say, we're simply going to be looking at the eyewitness documents and examining the Christian faith in as straightforward a way as possible. It will involve a little, we've called it home study, so as not to terrify you with that awful word homework. Will involve just a little bit of home study, which is why we've given you this little leaflet here. And as I say, there's an opportunity for you to ask me questions, to jot them down on that sheet of paper as you came in, and I'll try and reply to them by email, or somebody here will if I can't. And there are opportunities to ask questions around the table. Well, now, this week the talk title is Who is Jesus? And I want to ask you, if I may, to turn to page 3 of this eyewitness account of the life of Jesus, and to look at the very first sentence. The beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Gospel is a technical word, it means good news. Jesus is a name. And Christ, unlike some people think Christ was actually Jesus' surname, you know, William Taylor, Jesus Christ. Actually, Christ is another technical title, and it means anointed king. Son of God is also a technical title. A lot of people don't know that. Son of God is also a technical title. It is the title given to God's anointed king. So, the beginning of good news of Jesus, the Christ, who was the Son of God, the one we've been waiting for. Straight up then, I think we can kick into touch a number of popular misconceptions about Christianity. I grew up with a kind of arm's distance association with formal religion. So I went to a very, very formal church taken by my parents, and I went to a school where we had a kind of religious weekly assembly. And for me, I suppose, Christianity was all about rules, being good, and largely about not doing things. Christianity was all about religion, rather strange activities done at strange times, and it was all about ritual. Weird people dressed up in rather odd clothes, rather like extras out of the Mikado. It was a huge surprise to me, aged 18 and a half, to suddenly realize that Christianity is about a person, Jesus Christ, and that the heart of the Christian faith is a relationship with God's King, Jesus. I have a very good friend, some of you have heard me say this before, I have a very good friend who used to play rugby for Oxford, and then, in fact, it was Cambridge first, and then Oxford in the right order, and he was a second row forward. He stands about this tall, and he used to be about that wide. He's lost a bit of weight recently. And he gave a talk on this very point, that Christianity is about a relationship with Jesus Christ, at a children's camp that I used to be involved with. And it was his first ever talk. He was enormous. I think he was 18 stone at the time. And there he was, standing at the front, in shorts, in the heat of the summer, his knees knocking together. He had a brilliant talk. 3 points. Christianity is fact, not fiction. Friendship, not formula. Feast, not funeral. And he announced, to the horror of all those of us who were leading the children's holiday party, with all the conviction of a second year row forward in full flight, he announced, Christianity is fiction, not fact, formula, not friendship, and funeral, not feast. And the whole back row was sitting there going like this. It's a great truth, though, to realize that in the Christian faith, there is the opportunity of a relationship with my Creator in the person of his Son, Jesus. Mark wants us to know, however, who, not only who this Jesus is, but also why we can trust him. And so in the first half, the first 8 chapters of this account, which I hope you will read over the next few weeks, we have a series of staccato images of Jesus in operation. 6 headings, and in each we see Jesus is with all God's authority as teacher, over evil, over sickness, over nature, and so on. Let's have a look at chapter 1, verse 21 and 22. It's over the page, on page 4, and you can see Mark keeps on using this word immediately to present Jesus in action to us. They went, verse 21, halfway down page 4, they went into Capernaum, and immediately on the Sabbath he entered the synagogue and was teaching. And they were astonished at his teaching, for he taught them as one who had authority and not as the scribes. You can imagine the scene, gathered on the Sabbath to hear about God. Here are all the religious devotees of Capernaum, the scribes, the teachers of the law, the religious professionals, sitting in the front row of the synagogue with their sermons prepared. The children have been scrubbed and dragged away from their PlayStations, and the dads have laid aside the sports pages and are there with their families. Jesus appears. He starts to speak, and immediately it is apparent to absolutely everybody that this is a new kind of authority that they've never heard before. Did you see it there? He spoke to them as one who had authority and not as the scribes. Do you know Jesus, when he teaches in the Sermon on the Mount, quotes the Old Testament, God's word in the Old Testament. He says, you've heard that it was said in times long ago, quoting the Old Testament. And then he says, but I say to you. That's quite extraordinary. You know, the scribes and the authorities of the time, they all quoted their sources and depended absolutely on their sources. Jesus steps onto the scene and he says, oh, you've heard God said, but I say to you. And the people listening recognized immediately, here is a kind of authority we've never heard before. Let me say from a personal point of view, when I come to Jesus and his words, I find it lights up my life, cuts through all the waffle. You know, we listen endlessly to Thought for the Day and endure it in the Today program. We've sat through party political broadcasts and we've endured the moral maze and Oprah. And we've read any number of social and political commentators with their ideas and their solutions. It's as if Jesus, at last, is given a slot on Thought for the Day, rather a rare occurrence, actually. And as he speaks, it just cuts through everything. And then that morning, as you get into the office, well, going up in the lift to work, all the talk. Did you hear what he said? I've never heard anything like it before. It's as if he knows me. The Burton Albion result is relegated to second place in the discussion in the office, as all the talk is about Jesus Christ. Sorry, Burton Albion drew with Manchester United, yes. And we hope they might beat them. Is it tonight? But Jesus doesn't just speak with authority, he also then backs it up. And as I say, in the rest of the account, we see incident after incident of this authority of Jesus being demonstrated. Verse 23 to 28, here's the first one, his authority over evil. Page 4, and immediately there was in the synagogue a man with an unclean spirit, and he cried out, what have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God. But Jesus rebuked him, saying, be silent and come out of him. And the unclean spirit, convulsing him and crying out with a loud voice, came out. And they were all amazed, so that they questioned among themselves, saying, what is this? A new teaching with authority. He commands even the unclean spirits, and they obey him. And at once his fame spread everywhere throughout all the surrounding region. Isn't it interesting? He steps into the synagogue. Here's a guy who's obviously known by them all. He's part of the village. There he is in the synagogue. He recognized Jesus. And then Jesus, without so much as another sign or calling somebody in or another professional or a consultation, just with a word. No bell, book or candle. No Harry Potter and the Half-Wit. No Wingardium Leviosa. He speaks and it's gone. And then his authority over sickness, verse 29, page 5. Immediately he left the synagogue and entered the house of Simon and Andrew with James and John. Now Simon's mother-in-law lay ill with a fever, and immediately they told him about her, and he came and took her by the hand and lifted her up, and the fever left her, and she began to serve them. That evening at sunset, they brought to him all who were sick or oppressed by demons. I love that. The hospitals of Galilee emptied as people were brought to Jesus Christ. The whole city was gathered together at the door of the house. He healed many who were sick with various diseases and cast out many demons, and he wouldn't permit the demons to speak because they knew him. Oh, imagine, here comes Jesus into the city of London. He sets up to speak on the steps of Crédit Agricole. Within minutes, a vast crowd are gathered, as they were on the 11th of July. The offices begin to empty. You could hear a pin drop as he teaches. And then the crowd parts, and you think, what on earth's going on here? And here's a hospital bed. It's been wheeled down from Whitechapel, and the hospital just up there, where the medics have been struggling for months to diagnose what the problem is, and the man lying on it is brought through to Jesus. And with a word, he heals him. He jumps out of his bed, and he walks off well. And then the whole of, you can imagine what happens. The whole of the London hospital come down. They're all here. The TV crews and so on and so forth. See, Jesus doesn't just teach with authority. Those who were there and saw it and actually went to their death for what they saw, they insist that he acted with the authority of no one less than God himself. Let's just turn over a few pages. Page 12, here's another incident. Verse 35, page 12, two-thirds of the way down. On that day when evening had come, he said to his disciples, "Let's go across to the other side." And leaving the crowd, they took him with them in the boat, just as he was, and other boats were with him. And a great windstorm arose, and the waves were breaking into the boat, so that the boat was already filling. But he was in the stern, asleep on the cushion. Isn't that extraordinary? So unperturbed by the ravages of nature that he's just asleep. It doesn't bother him. They awoke him and said to him, "Teacher, don't you care that we're perishing?" And he awoke and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Peace, be still." And the wind ceased and there was a great calm. He said to them, "Why are you so afraid? Have you still no faith?" And they were filled with great fear and said to one another, "Who then is this that even wind and sea obey him?" I love that, isn't it? Why are you so afraid? Have you still no faith? Not, "Hey, look what I just did." But didn't you believe I could do it? The arrogance of the man, if he isn't who he says he is preposterous. And you can imagine it, can't you, with the disciples. They're all experienced fishermen. Squalls often break out on the Sea of Galilee, I'm told. I once heard a meteorologist telling us why it is that squalls often break out on the Sea of Galilee. I can't remember a word of what he says, except that squalls often do break out. But they must have been in the most severe storms. This is so severe as the very elements rise up in protest against God's king. This is so severe that even these experienced fishermen, as they dangle on to the mast, have to eventually to wake up Jesus. And he says, "What's the matter with you? Don't you trust me?" And then with a word, he speaks. It's as if he stood on the beaches of Southeast Asia as the wall of water came towards him and just said, "Stop." Let me say, if you don't think that is a pretty remarkable thing to do, why not give it a go? And next time you're crossing the channel, perhaps, go to the back of the boat, if they're still in operation by then. I know P&O lurch from one crisis to another. But go and stand on the back of the boat. Do it somewhere very quietly, I would, if I was you out the back when no one's watching. And just give it a go and see how you get on. Then, remarkably, verse 41 of chapter 5, over the page, power over death. Where we find ourselves so utterly powerless, Jesus is master. So, page 14, verse 21, when Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side, a great crowd gathered about him, and he was beside the sea. There came one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus by name, and seeing him, he fell at his feet and implored Jesus earnestly, saying, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her so that she may be made well and live." And he went with him. And then over the page to page 15 at the top. While he was still speaking, there came from the ruler's house someone who said, "Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?" But overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the ruler of the synagogue, "Don't fear, only believe." And he allowed no one to follow him except Peter and James and John, the brother of James. They came to the house of the ruler of the synagogue. Seeing the commotion, people weeping and wailing loudly, he entered. He said to them, "Why are you making a commotion and weeping?" And it's a preposterous thing to say, isn't it, at this little girl's funeral? Why are you weeping? Then he said, "This child is not dead, but sleeping." They laughed at him. He put them all outside, took the child's father and mother, and those who were with him, and went in where the child was. Taking her by the hand, he said to her, "Talitha kumi," which means, "Little girl, I say to you, arise." And immediately the girl got up and began walking, for she was 12 years of age, and they were immediately overcome with amazement. The last few months I've taken a number of very desperately sad funerals. Each one of them, actually, lives ended very prematurely, one by cancer, one by heart failure, one by disaster, and one by the wickedness of Islamic fundamentalism. You know, standing at the cot side of a seven-week-old baby with the child's grieving mother and father, one is especially aware of human helplessness in the face of death. I would have given anything in the world to be able to say, "Little boy, get up." To have said that would have been grotesquely inappropriate unless I could pull it off. And Jesus says to this 12-year-old, notice she was 12, that's why she walked off, says Mark. I mean, they were there, you see, Peter was there. Jesus says to this 12-year-old, "Little girl, get up." Now, she's not asleep, she's not dead, she's just asleep. "Get up." And up she gets. Well, I wanted to take us to one other incident, and that's in chapter 2. It's just back a few pages. I wonder if you just turn back there for one moment. And chapter 2, and it's the healing of the paralytic. And I'll just talk us through it very quickly before I ask you. I've got a question for you, actually. Normally at these Thursdays, you all ask me questions. And I thought, I just want to turn the tables for a change. I'm going to ask you a question just to discuss around the tables. I hope you don't mind. It's not a difficult one. Chapter 2, verse 1. When he entered, returned to Capernaum, top of page 6 there, it was reported that he was at home, and many were gathered together, so that there was no more room, not even at the door. And he was preaching the word to them. They came, bringing to him a paralytic carried by 4 men. When they couldn't get near him because of the crowd, they removed the roof above him, and when they had made an opening, they let down the bed on which the paralytic lay. And when Jesus saw their faith, he said to the paralytic, what do you think? I mean, I know you know what they said. I mean, but what would you expect him to say? This guy is paralyzed. He cannot move. His limbs are withered. His muscles are withered. His joints are knotted, tied together and contracted. His friends have brought him. They couldn't get in, so they go up on the side. They find the place where they think Jesus must be. To the horror of the house owner, they start tearing. The house owner rushes off to check his insurance policy and make sure he's paid his last installment, and hope to goodness he's not insured with one of your companies. Then this body arrives in front of him. And there is this man, helpless. Maybe he can't even speak. We don't know. What do you expect Jesus to say? Isn't it the most preposterous thing we've heard so far? "My son, your sins are forgiven." Not only is it utterly inappropriate, it is also supremely arrogant. Because all sin is against God. And for a human being to turn to a person who he's never met in his life before and say, "Oh, by the way, everything you've done wrong against God, I forgive you." Well, verse 7, the religious professionals know exactly what he's saying. Why does this man speak like that? He is blaspheming. Who can forgive sins but God alone? And immediately Jesus, perceiving in his spirit that they thus questioned within themselves, said to them, "Why do you question these?" Again, the arrogance. "Why do you question these things in your heart? How dare you question that I'm God?" Which is easier to say to the paralytic, "Your sins are forgiven," or to say, "Rise, take up your bed and walk"? Well, it's far harder to say your sins are forgiven, because only God can do that. "But so that you may know that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins," he said to the paralytic, "I say to you, rise, pick up your bed, and go home." And he rose and immediately picked up his bed, and he danced out of the room, singing praise and thanks to God. So here's my question then, and it's a very simple one. I just wondered if you might discuss around the tables for a few moments Before you get on to the Burton Albion result, I wonder if you might discuss the question, who do you then think Jesus is? Who do you think Jesus is? That's a straightforward question. What's your view about this Jesus? And then I'll round us up in about 8 minutes' time, but 2 minutes more, and I'll just draw us together in 8 minutes at just before 10:02, and then we will leave at 10:02. Well, finish at 10:02. You can leave when you want. Well, I can't help wishing I could know how you got on. I hope you got on all right. I wonder how you got on. I just want, as we close, then to draw a couple of threads together and present you with something you will have heard if you've been to see the Narnia film. Remember in Narnia where, what's the name of the professor? I'm going to ask another question. Who saw the Narnia film and didn't cry? I mean, that is a big question, isn't it? My kids were absolutely all over the shop. Anyway, I won't tell you where I was. In the Narnia film, remember the professor says, logic. Don't they teach logic in the schools these days? See, what I've drawn out on the bottom of this sheet here for you is straight from C.S. Lewis, and C.S. Lewis puts it in the Narnia story in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Get your copy out when you get home and have a look. You'll find it about 20 pages in when the littlest one, is it Lucy, comes and says, of course, the lion and the world and all the rest, and he says, and he presents this frame of logic in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. He also presents it in this excellent little book called Mere Christianity, where he's arguing for Christianity. And he's wanting us to think logically. And what I've done is to draw out this little chart for you. See, Jesus, there's no doubt he claims to be God. There is no doubt that he claims to be God. You cannot have listened to what we've just been looking at. And come and talk to me if you don't think he does. But the eyewitnesses all understood him to be claimed to be God. That's why he was crucified. He acted as if he was God. The question is he? And there are really only three options. Either he was lying, in which case you would have to leave here saying you think Jesus is wicked. Or he was deluded, in which case you would have to leave here saying, at least in some sense, Jesus is deranged. Or what he's saying is true. In which case, of course, it has real implications, which we'll come on to as the course goes on. Let me give the last word then to C.S. Lewis. I'm trying here to prevent anyone saying the really foolish thing that people often say about Jesus. I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. That is the one thing we must not say. A man who is merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would be either a lunatic on a level with the man who says he's a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman, or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool, you can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come up with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us, and he didn't intend to. Well, thank you very much indeed for coming. I really hope we'll see you next week. Please do come back. Bring friends and colleagues. Hey, it's totally open and easygoing, I hope, this course. We won't embarrass anybody with anything, nothing strange, just straight looking at what Jesus said and did.